Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, I'm on the road this week at production time, so we have another double feature, a pair of episodes that were produced by Ken Lane right around this time of year. Our first episode is Aliens, Marijuana, and Other Monsters from November 24th, 2017. Brendan Mays is still trying to turn a profit. Enjoy!
From Palm Springs in the California desert, now is the time for Desert Oracle Live.
Well, it is nighttime in the desert. Once again, just look outside. We're having a fine evening at the Ace Hotel and Swim Club here in Palm Springs, playground of the presidents, as they say, and luckily not the case right now. Tonight we bring strange tales from the vast American desert, a land of weird schemes and enduring mysteries. Since ancient times here, for as long as humans have lived upon this arid landscape, there have been sightings of strange lights in the sky, fireballs that follow you around, even airships in broad daylight. Now, Death Valley got its English name from some gold rush bozos who got lost out there trying to get to the California that they'd read about in the newspapers, the land of milk and honey, and mostly the land of easy pickings, the land where you could pick gold right up off the ground. But that big valley with the Funeral and Panamint Mountains rising up on either side, great walls of rock topped with cool forest opinion, was and is the home of Shoshone people, Paiute tribes that have called the place home for ages. The tribe that calls itself Timbisha today. The valley floor is just fine in the winter months. And when it gets hot, the people would pack up and they would head for the pine forest. They would go up there and live in relative comfort, hunting deer and bighorn, collecting pinion nuts, and watching these mystery skyships that would travel from mountain peak to mountain peak across the immense valley we call Death Valley. The ships they thought of as canoes, the ships of another race, the race of the old ones. In 1947, a Washington State businessman and private pilot named Kenneth Arnold watched in amazement from the cockpit of his private plane as a fleet of boomerang-shaped craft maneuvered over and around the Cascades at tremendous speeds. The whole country, the whole world, really quickly went nuts for the flying saucers. 2 years later, with the UFO panic still growing, a magazine called Fate, the same magazine that published Kenneth Arnold's first-person story of his famous encounter, published a curious tale called Tribal Memories of the Flying Saucers. A transcribed conversation between a visiting Navajo writer and a Timbisha elder, the article quotes the elder as saying, "We, the Paiute Nation, have known of these ships for untold generations. We also believe that we know something of the people who fly them." These stories were often neglected by the self-appointed UFO experts because it did not fit easily into the popular theory of the time, our time. The popular theory that the often-seen mystery craft in our earthly skies had to be spaceships, had to be filled with space aliens. It fit our mindset at the dawn of the still new space age. It fit our science fiction stories. In time and in our present time, the old stories became so separated from our space age theories that the easiest way to scare off an intrepid UFO researcher was to mention that your sighting also featured a hairy monstrosity with eyes like burning coal. From the high desert cowboy movie set village of Pioneertown, We are very happy to have the documentary filmmaker Jeremy Corbell. Jeremy, if you're out there in the dark, please come on up to the phone booth. Let's welcome Jeremy Corbell to Desert Oracle Radio. Your films live on extraordinarybeliefs.com.
Yeah, currently on iTunes as well, yeah.
I brought up these ancient tales from Death Valley and here in Palm Springs because it will go well with something I want to ask you about. We've talked about it a little bit before, but it's a place that has utterly fascinated me since I first read about it in the Deseret News in 1996. It's a place known to connoisseurs of the weird as the old Sherman Ranch, the Bigelow property, the Skinwalker Ranch.
This place is a concentrated area for this activity. But beyond lights in the sky, they report about creatures on the ground. And this is something that was studied by our military defense, by our government. And it was also studied by about seven scientists for 7 years under the Bigelow Aerospace Company.
And this is Robert Bigelow.
Robert Bigelow. He's a billionaire.
And he made his money off extended stay motels. Is that
correct? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just absolutely. That's how
he
did.
And he ran a paranormal wing of University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
Yeah, and he also ran NIDS, which is the National Institute for Discovery Science. And that was incredible. So that was the most scientific organization to look at a paranormal hotspot in history. So they focused on Skinwalker Ranch because he owned and bought Skinwalker Ranch. But this goes back to 1994 when the Shermans bought the ranch, right? And then essentially from there, it was just chaos. I mean, the family was in disarray. The things that were happening to them, to straight-A student children, went to F's. The wife who was a banker.
This happened to my children once.
Yeah, yeah, it's messed up. It's messed up. Man, you got the most mysterious voice in the whole Mojave Desert. I don't know if you're old or young. It's pretty wild.
Thank you, Jeremy. So you have been welcomed onto this property. This property that has... Now, I went by there one time.
You did.
And there was an old country fence. But you showed me pictures of the fence that exists there now. And it looks like the fence outside a military base, outside of Cheyenne Mountain or something.
Yeah, there's been a lot of attention at this ranch, being that it is one of the hot spots in the area for this type of activity, both by the military and also by these unknown visitors. And so they have fortified the property. Because it is private property, you cannot just go there. But if you're invited, you can go on. And there's a handful of people on this earth that have been invited. And I was invited. And I was able to go on the ranch. And it is a strange and bizarre place.
Tell me three weird things that people have seen on this property.
Well, I saw my drone crash into my mentor in journalism named George Knapp. It just went right into him. And it was probably operator error, but... I'm going to blame it on the Skinwalker. So the way I got involved with Skinwalker Ranch is because my mentor in journalism, George Knapp, with a scientist named Colm Kelleher, they wrote a book called Hunt for the Skinwalker. And that's how I learned about this story. And so reading that book is a first good step to understanding the chaos and the weirdness.
Now, but this spun off from George Knapp's articles in the Las Vegas Weekly, right?
It in fact did, yeah. I mean, the story went to the Associated Press when the rancher came out and said, we're having weird stuff going on, and he thought it was the government, and he wanted to get attention to make sure they weren't trying to take his ranch or something. But in fact, the history of chaos on this ranch was happening way before. And so when that came out, George started reporting on it, and actually he's had to keep secret about a lot of stuff because Bigelow owned it, and it was all private information.
But there are things that were reported. For instance, there was a report of a kind of beast, you know, the kind of thing that we hear with the Yucca Man or the Taquits, a shaggy, red-eyed monstrosity, etc. And also triangular ships appearing, portals opening.
Man, it's wild out there. So, I mean, I got to talk with some of the police officers who patrol the area, and not like out here in the high desert or low desert when you hear, you know, of chaos in a house. You chalk it up to methamphetamine. This is this is wild. They have to take every report seriously. So everything from lights in the sky to motherships to creatures. And a lot of this has been filmed and documented by the scientific organization NIDS when Bigelow owned it. A lot of that footage is coming out through my films in the next couple years.
Have you seen anything particularly weird on the property?
It's strange, man. I was the most skeptical I've ever been when I was on the property. If I saw something weird, I'd chalk it up to something normal. But
flying a drone into George.
Yeah, just flying the drone right into his face. Oh, man, I feel bad about that. Look, being in the path of the Skinwalker, we were the first people ever allowed to actually camp and film and take that footage off the Ute Reservation. We got tribal elders to give us the permission to do that. That footage will be coming out. And absolutely, it was bizarre, man. It was strange. I did see things there that I had never seen anywhere else.
Come on, tell us.
Well, look, a lot of it's inconclusive, man. I mean, here's the deal. The phenomenon never repeats itself. So you go out there, you see something. I mean, the whole place lit up. We had lights the first night just looking at the ranch, but we found no source of the lights. We have nothing to report. There were lights. But, like, a lot of the people that live there, they are now talking to us, and we are documenting their experiences, and we are going to bring it out to you guys so you can hear what they're talking about.
I want to go, you know, in the property.
You might freak out the things that freak people out, so I have to be careful of that.
The thing that stands out most to me 20 years later is that these people who lived in the house had locks on the inside of all the closets.
Yeah. So the family that lived there, by the end of their time there, they were huddled in just a, you know, their beds close together. It is something these families take seriously. And this area, I wouldn't believe it unless I saw it for myself. There's something to be revealed from this investigation. And I'm just at the end of it now.
All right. Well, we're going to look for that. Tell us about your movie, Patient 17, which is out now on iTunes, right?
Yes, wild movie, man. So Patient 17. So this was an abduction story that turned into some alien implant story, and I did not want to touch it with a 10-foot pole, but I met the guy. I met the guy who it happened to, and he convinced me that something was to this. And so I made a movie about it, and you could watch it on iTunes, and basically it's me stumbling around trying to figure out if there's anything to this story. And in fact, the scientific evidence shows there is.
So the story is a doctor named Dr. Roger Lear, right?
That's right.
And he's general practitioner, podiatrist.
He's a podiatrist, yeah.
So, and he got this idea from reports that people were finding little metallic things in their bodies just under the skin, and they thought that these might be some kind of transmitters to the aliens, right?
Yeah.
And he took out how many of these?
Well, so Patient 17 is the title of my movie. He's had 17 alleged implant removal surgeries. He died in the middle of filming of my, not on
Did
camera.
Did you crash a drone into him?
No, I didn't. But it is a joke going around that don't film with me, because a lot of people I film, they're dead now, so... Sorry.
In each of these surgeries, something comes out,
yeah,
right? Some kind of weird-looking little, like, metal cylinder.
Yeah. Very objectively, there were foreign bodies taken out of individuals who had abductive experiences. The only one that I've studied scientifically is patient 17's. And in that one, we have zinc isotopes that are non-terrestrial definitively, unless the test is flawed. So we're getting more tests. But, yeah, absolutely, it's a strange... 36 elements in this alloy, some of which are rare earth elements.
And the patient himself, tell us a little bit about patient 17.
I mean, I describe him like a cowboy. He's kind of like soft-spoken, and he's stoic, and he is the biggest skeptic throughout this whole experience. He knows that he had abductive experiences, but he has no idea what this thing was in his body. His eyes lit up like flying saucers when he saw the results, the scientific results.
A real thing.
Yeah, it's something is real about this.
All right, Jeremy, it's not coast to coast. We're out of time. thank you so much. We're going to do that thing that we can't talk about on Sunday, but Jeremy Corbell, director, Patient 17, it's weird stuff.
Yeah, the Desert Oracle has blown my mind. Thanks for having me, Ken.
Thank you, Jeremy. I still can't watch the part with the surgery. I don't like that. Now, I want to tell you about a place not far from here. It's on the Butterfield stage route that connected the old Southern California desert and mountain towns of Borrego Springs and Warner Springs. And it's called Dead Man's Hole. At this oasis, a miner with his jackass or a stagecoach full of travelers could stop to water themselves, water their animals, enjoy the shade, enjoy a rest. The story emerged over time that there, as pretty much everywhere in Southern California, perhaps everywhere, there was a monster. Well, we've got Brendan Mays here. Brendan Mays, everyone. Good to see you. What
I'm sorry about
happened.
That, Ken. I was at, I got late. I was, you know, it's out in a...
Palm Springs traffic, a little heavy.
No, I was out in Desert Hot Springs, and I just got...
It's a call-in show, you know. It's for you. Yeah, pick it up.
Thank you. All right. Yeah, I was in Desert Hot Springs. You know, they got these the Range Rovers, you know, the cars that can go anywhere, right? Well, it's the commercials. They're driving out there and... blasting through snowbanks and doing donuts in the desert and everything, scattering animals. But you got stuck in the sand. You pull off the side of the road on a soft shoulder, and I was stuck. I was stuck there for about 3 hours.
What are you doing up there?
Well, you know, Ken, we were doing quite a few things out there. You know, we at the Mojave Mirage Company are actively scouting locations for expansion of our operations. We're looking to extend the Mojave Mirage Refreshment Solutions brand into one of the most lucrative business opportunities in a generation. I'm excited to announce here tonight the launch of Mojave Mirage Mystic Mist Herbal Sensations.
You doing a dope grow? You're growing marijuana?
Well, yes, actually, Ken, that's exactly what we're doing. We're going to be having a grow operation out there. We plan on having a full line of smokables, edibles, infused beverages, you know, cosmetic and therapeutic salves and creams, lip balm, and, you know, whatnot, you know. So if you want to add a little THC to your life, we want to be there to help you. Look, Ken, this is it's a huge industry, right? There's a retail sales last
when
year.
When does it become legal in California?
I believe it becomes January 1st. It becomes legal, you know? Uh-huh. I mean, that's something to celebrate, right? I mean, it's going to grow to $30 billion by 2020. That's a compound growth rate of over 17%. That's going to earn a lot of people a lot of money.
Big earnings,
yeah. There's a tremendous interest we have, you know, from international investment bankers and hedge funds. And we've got main backing from a few Chinese generals and provincial governors looking to move the cash out, you know. We got a horticultural scientist from Oregon State University. We've got law enforcement experts from Del Norte County. Food Machine Corporation is in on it. This is going to be really big.
Why Desert Hot Springs in particular?
There were four considerations we were looking at. One of them, of course, was cheap land. Well, land out there in Desert Hot Springs is really cheap. Second thing, water. There's water everywhere. You could probably pump 1 million gallons, you know, and nobody would even notice it. Not a drop. And then, of course, we have cheap labor. I mean, just look around. You know, there's all these people standing around doing nothing, walking around in ditches, spinning these weird yo-yo things, walking down the road. And, of course, you know, number four, which is very important, is we have very lax law enforcement. And so that's what we were looking at. Let me just go over my notes here for a second.
So what you're looking at is a commercial grow operation. I assume you're going to be doing this indoors?
We will be doing this indoors,
what,
yes.
Do you have your prospectus there?
Well, I've got my prospectus here, and it looks like I'm missing a page of my prospectus, unfortunately, which had a lot of really good information on it.
There are certainly investors out here, so, you know, if you have a way to approach it that differs from every other marijuana company in America,
Well, we're going to do an approach of trying to get local jobs for the local economy. Uh-huh. You know, something like 55% of the area residents are dependent on some sort of government assistance. And we're looking to break that cycle of intergenerational dependency on the government with the best known antidote, good paying jobs. You know, I say to people, hey, you know, if you're looking for purpose in life, this is it. We're offering the chance for literally hundreds of people to stop being a drag on society, stop being a drain on the public goodwill of hardworking Americans, beginning an exciting and rewarding career, contributing not only to their own pocketbooks, but to the happiness and betterment of society in general.
By selling recreational dope.
Yep, yeah, by selling recreational dope. That's how we're going to do it.
Uh-huh. Now, you're going to be doing this, I assume, indoors?
We're going to be doing it indoors. We're starting with outdoor test plots right now.
In desert hot springs.
In desert hot springs, yes, that's right.
What is your farming background, Brendan, if I could ask?
Well, I tried to get in on the organic farming movement back in 1999 with a little farm I had up in the Bay Area, and we... turns out pesticides are really, really important for growing crops. You know, but verticillium wilt. I mean, there's a million things that'll take you out right at the knees. And we lost a lot of money, but it was a good effort. It was a good effort.
The actual reason I invited you to the show is not because of whatever this is, but because of these flyers you've got all over Joshua Tree. I saw them at the Yucca Valley Swap Meet.
Yes, that's right. Paper the town.
Yeah, a mindfulness institute of some kind? You were offering a master's degree in mindfulness.
We are offering, absolutely. Yes, Ken, we are proud to talk for the first time openly about our joint project with the Magic Mystic line of recreational marijuana. We're going to be opening the Mojave Mindfulness Master's Institute in conjunction with the launch of the Mystic Mist line. Yeah. Look, we're a little bit late to this game, right? We needed something, some sort of gimmick, you know, like anything that would help differentiate ourselves from the rest of the competition. So we reached out to the Cistercians, but they're quite savvy, you know, they're good marketers. They wanted a majority-minority holding and control over creative and distribution, which
you
we were not
You were marketing
giving.
This thing in Joshua Tree as a Buddhist mindfulness retreat that will give degrees of some kind to those who take part. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's basically correct, yes. Yes, that's basically correct.
Do you yourself have any background in Buddhism?
I'm no expert in Buddhism. I'm no expert in Christianity. I'm no expert in Islam or anything. I just know what works. I bring business savvy, knowledge, and acumen to anything that, any sort of project that we can dream up.
From the look of the flyers, and honestly, I only knew it was you because it was your Hotmail address on the little tabs.
Hotmail. It's so dated.
You seem to be marketing this as a high desert, Joshua Tree, millennial, hipster, mindfulness kind of thing.
Yes.
And a sense that one could have personal and corporate growth by becoming more mindful. How does this play into the Desert Hot Springs property?
Well, you know, we had to recapture the spiritual essence of the Mojave Mirage brand. And if you know anything about this area, you know, there's a lot of many Zen practitioners and organizations out here. So we reached out to our friends in Silicon Valley. We have quite a few friends up there in social media and the software magnates up there. And so they turned us on to a more corporate-friendly version of Zen Buddhism. It's called mindfulness. And get this, it's about breathing. I mean, what's easier than that? What's easier than breathing? Every day, people around the world and every single country are breathing. And we want to be a part of that. I mean, come on, how easy is that? So anyway, we got a Zen master in training from the Zen Center near San Francisco. The program begins with, of course, the beginner's mind, which is that state of childlike naivete and openness to everything. The foundation of mindfulness, beginners will then follow the program, advancing to successive levels of achievement, such as silver and gold mined status, before finally reaching the platinum level and graduating, you know, with a certificate, with a platinum mind. So far, all Watanabe has sent us is a one-page curriculum with the word breathe on it printed 66 times.
When do you hope to be bringing your first students, I guess they're students, to Desert Hot Springs, and what will they do there?
Zen Master Suzuki said, fall down 7 times and get up 8 times. Well, guess what? There's exactly 8 stages to the growing, processing, and packaging of marijuana. It's like a natural fit. It's like something from God, or if you didn't believe in God, some other religious thing. So, like many Zen Buddhist centers, we're centering it on the concept of...
Brendan, we've run out of time. I thank you for joining us.
My elevator pitch is at the end.
Brendan Mays, everybody.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming. Check your tires. A quick story before we leave you, friends, a story that you will remember more than any story about philosophy or business or monsters, because this story is about real estate. Better yet, it's about free real estate. Free real estate, the desert dream, the kingdom of heaven upon the earth. Well, free real estate is what the U.S. government was offering to common Americans, no bribe necessary. And all you had to do was go up to the Bureau of Land Management office and make your claim upon one of the 5-acre parcels made available by the Small Homestead Act of 1938. 437,000 acres of the Morongo Basin, including prime chunks of Pioneer Town, Landers, Joshua Tree, and Wonder Valley, were up for grabs. But only a third of those parcels went into private hands because the desert was wild and harder to get to then. No water lines, no electricity. For many years, no telephone, no television, no Netflix. But the biggest hurdle was the requirement to prove up your claim, to build a cabin that met what in Silicon Valley is called the minimum viable specifications. A one-room shack, 400 square feet. Sometimes you had to have an outhouse out back to get your deed. Well, people with a little bit of money could buy a prefab cabin for about $1,400 in the 1950s. It would be installed on a slab on your 5 acres in the desert. Of course, if you had a truckload of lumber and you brought your buddies from work, a couple of cases of Budweiser or Golden Grain all chilled up like the Dickens, maybe you could put up a cabin in a weekend. You'd have a cozy cinder block fireplace. Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys broadcasting live from KMJ in Fresno. Skies so full of stars that even on a moonless summer night, you could walk outside barefoot and walk around the scorpions. Well, people made their claims, but many failed to prove they had built the required homestead cabin, and those parcels went back to the BLM. They became public land, desert, still out there today. One of those homestead flunkies was none other than Ronald Reagan. Now, Ronald Reagan got a taste for the desert when he was making Death Valley Days. And he came out and he made a claim, but he failed to prove up. He never built his homestead cabin. And that lot, we don't know exactly where it is, but it went back into the desert. And because of that, the high desert never became the playground of the presidents. That remained this area, Rancho Mirage, Thunderbird Club, Palm Desert. And the high desert remains a place that is left to the people least likely to start a nuclear war, even if they wanted to. Our announcer tonight was Alana Mae Johnson. We did this event with the kind help of the Ace Hotel and Swim Club, especially Rohini Walker and Kate Naylor. Our theme music was composed by Pierre Langer. Tonight's show included ambient tracks made for this program by the artist Red, Blue, Black, Silver in Joshua Tree. We are on Z107 FM in Joshua Tree, Friday nights at 10 p.m. Thank you so much for coming. This is the first time we did it. You all made it great. Thank you.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
We are at the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Our next episode is Of Fire and Monsters from November 16th, 2018. By the way, I'm hoping to hear your local monster stories. Give it some thought. For now, enjoy. Ha ha ha!
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, and that's when we like to tell monster stories. Weird tales. The thing about monster stories is that every country and every region and every culture has its own monsters. And if you hear some local legends of some monster people claim to have encountered on back roads or around abandoned mines or wherever it is, you can almost always go back in the historical record and find similar reports from long ago. As in the case of the Sasquatch. The Sasquatch of our local mountains, the San Bernardinos, the Little San Bernardino Mountains, here in Joshua Tree, the San Jacintos looming over the Coachella Valley. As Southern California began to fill up with people and suburbs between the 1950s and 1970s, people from Palmdale to Rialto, from Fontana to 29 Palms, reported seeing a huge hairy beast lumbering through the night, 8 feet tall, walking on two legs. And it turned out the local Indian tribes had stories of the same kinds of creatures. Whether on the desert or the coastal side of the Southern California mountains, there was a similar name for these mysterious beasts. On the Santa Ana River, Spanish friars heard the name Taqui, and noted areas where the tribes refused to camp because it was the domain of the Taqui. In Palm Springs, there's a reason why you see the name Taquitos all over the place. There's a canyon right behind Palm Springs called Taquitos Canyon. It is the home of the Taquitos, a mythical magician of the Cahuilla tribe who went mad and became a shaggy, red-eyed monster. Or a glowing green orb of light chasing people down the canyon. There's an odor that often comes with such experiences. It's the odor of rotten eggs, of sulfur. Well, if you collect this type of strange tale, eventually people will come up afterwards and tell you their own experiences, or they ask if you believe in the things yourself. If you believe in monsters. Well, you can believe that people see things in the night sky, in the Joshua Tree woodlands. You can believe there is something going on now and then, without believing in monstrosities as some sort of flesh and blood animal. There is no physical evidence for any kind of monster beyond the well-known human monsters responsible for all the evil in the world. There are no bones, no bodies, no fur, no teeth, no DNA. No photos or films or videos that haven't been questionable. And yet we humans keep encountering things that don't match any known animal, any plausible species. And we always have, from the time of Moses with his weird talking lights in the desert brush. From the medieval times of Europe with the trolls and the elves and the fair folk that inspired 1,000 fairy tales and ceaseless hours of Hobbit movies. From Chupacabra and Puerto Rico to the ghost lights of Marfa. From flying witches over Mexico City. To the notorious skunk ape of Florida's wounded Everglades. The word monster comes from ancient Latin. Monstrum, meaning a divine omen, a sign from the gods. And our modern word demonstrate at one time meant an appearance of a spectral omen. And here's where the ancients had, I think, a much better understanding of the phenomenon. You can hunt Bigfoot all you want, but you'll never find it. It will demonstrate its existence at the time and the place of its choosing. And then it's gone. Rather than going after ghosts with ridiculous electronic gadgets or taking plaster measurements of dubious Sasquatch footprints or trying to classify the thousands of different aliens and UFOs that have been reported all over the world, maybe we should approach these things the way they were long seen. As portents, as signs, as symbols and archetypes that might be telling us things of importance. It's a mystery where such entities come from, and you can really take your choice of explanations. From the old religious ideas of gods and angels and demons, to the old Nordic and Celtic folklore of races of creatures living in fairyland alongside our own world. The great psychologist and psychiatrist Carl Jung believed our own collective consciousness generated symbols and archetypes that functioned as instinctual memory, which appeared at important times in our lives and gave us the same kind of untaught learning that a desert tortoise or young coyote knows about its place in the world, how to exist and thrive within its natural environment. And you can make science out of it too, if you want, because quantum physics suggests there are many dimensions, many variations of time and space. And we may well be living alongside different versions of our own world. Alternate realities that occasionally mesh with our own. Perhaps like the Celtic priest said of the old Halloween rituals, there are places and times where the veil between worlds is thin. If you look at reports of monsters and strange creatures and UFOs long enough, you'll find that most of them occur where the wilderness meets civilization. The frontier. The wildland-urban interface, as our exhausted firefighters call it. When you add trauma to these places, especially the trauma of dramatic changes to the environment, the building of suburbs and freeways and factories over once wild and empty places, something seems to be triggered. Maybe it comes from our own worries about being on the edge of civilization, even if we like it here. Even if we wouldn't live anywhere else. Maybe it comes from the collective unconscious. An uneasiness that comes with uprooting ourselves and uprooting the native plants and animals where we will make our homes, our military bases, our toxic waste dumps. The harsh, hot badlands that comprise much of Anza-Borrego State Park are home to many strange and terrible stories of the creature that has been called the Missing Link or the Borrego Sandman, The Sandman has been seen by 20th century gold hunters and rock hounds and is most often described as being an enormous primate with whitish fur and glowing red eyes. And the missing link of Dead Man's Hole is reportedly a mass murderer. Once the gold rush reached Southern California's mountains and deserts in the later 1800s, prospectors and bandits quickly made the area home. Discoveries of gold at Julian and in the desert to the east brought many hopeful miners to the scorching San Diego County desert, and many stagecoaches loaded with suspicious characters. One of them, Peg Leg Smith, claimed to find and then lose a mine near the Salton Sea where gold nuggets could be picked up off the ground. And a couple of characters from Julian, Edward Dean and Charles Cox, claimed to have shot a Sasquatch dead. An 1878 article in the San Diego Daily Transcript reported that the men had found and then killed the monster at Dead Man's Hole, northeast of Warner Springs. Delivery of the mysterious creature's corpse was promised, but it never appeared in San Diego. And more than a century later, a Daily Transcript reporter named Herbert Lockwood went digging for the old story and noted that it was published in an 1878 issue dated April 1. It was March of 1876 when a more credible report appeared in the San Diego Union. A man named Turner Helm claimed he saw the missing link near Warner's Ranch, about 4 miles south of present-day Warner Springs. Described as a bear-like giant with a human face, the report generated great interest because of the many unsolved murders at Dead Man's Hole. Then a water stop on the Butterfield stage line. The bodies had been piling up at the stagecoach stop's waterhole for 2 decades by then, with the victims including a French Basque shepherd, several dubious individuals on the run from the law or creditors, and a wealthy San Franciscan named William Blair. Many of the victims were found with bruised and broken necks, their money and gold untouched. The most recent unsolved murder at the waterhole dates to 1922, less than a century ago. When, again, a strangled victim was found there 64 years after the first recorded murders at the hole. Dead Man's Hole, Dead Man Hole on modern maps, is located in a grove of live oaks about 15 yards east of California State 79, an 8-mile drive up from today's Warner Springs. Just southeast of the place called Tocqui, at the headwaters of the Santa Margarita River. The Tocqui, or Taquits as it is known in the canyons of Palm Springs, is the hairy devil, first reported by the Tongva people to the Spanish friars in the 18th century. The visitor to Dead Man's Hole of today should look for the small, plainly lettered sign that reads U.S. Navy Remote Training Area at an unmarked crossroads just before Sunshine Summit. As at Edwards Air Force Base and 29 Palms, here at Dead Man's Hole, the U.S. military trains side by side with the elusive Sasquatch of Southern California's wild lands. It was the common belief in England until modern times that Stonehenge was the work of Merlin, the great magician and favorite of the Romano-Britain kings. Nobody had much of an idea how the ancient circle of stones came to be. So the legend grew that Merlin had transported an outdoor temple of the giants all the way from Ireland and placed it on the plain as a war memorial to those last of the Celtic princes lost to the treachery of the invading Saxons. When we don't know the purpose of a monumental structure, whether ancient or abandoned modern, we dream up a purpose for it, and then that purpose becomes real, even when the busy work of researchers eventually reveals more mundane origins. Several months back, our friend Jason P. Woodbury of Aquarium Drunkard helped us with a show at the Valley Bar in Phoenix. And we did wind up talking on the telephone about devils and demons and the strange accidental temples of the Valley of the Sun. Accidental landmarks, important things that rise up in the desert, not because they were intended as temples or monuments or religious centers, like the Casa Grande ruins, but because of chaos and accident.
Yeah, I think that one of the most interesting things about structures here in the desert is that they seem to take on a character that is maybe different than what people intended for them. Recently, I had the pleasure of heading out to the Casa Grande domes. Have you ever heard of the domes, Ken?
Oh, I've heard about them. I recall editing an article about them in the current issue of Desert Oracle. Now, these are not the famous ruins.
No, the ruins are actually located a town over in Coolidge, Arizona, which happens to be where I grew up. They've got some Coolidge. Some Coolidge people here in the front row. But no, the ruins are slightly more majestic and a little bit more mysterious than the domes. But the domes are out. You can get there. They're just south of Casa Grande, and they're very weird. They're these structures that were built in the early 80s for like a microchip processing plant.
So they were making computer chips in America.
They were making computer chips in America, in Pinal County, actually.
Was what, 1981?
This was 82 is when they built these things. And they didn't last long. In fact, they never even got all the way to the point where they were cranking out products for people. So they were abandoned and have taken on, in the decades since, kind of a weird allure for the weird kids in Pinal County.
And you can see them from the interstate.
You can. You head off and you head down a dirt road, and they are, there's a fence around them that has been pretty well ignored for a couple decades. Although my brother was out there, and the owner did show up, and he told him that it's $40 a person to take photos there.
$40? Yeah, Instagram has ruined everything.
So, yeah, he's got that Instagram coin going. But the problem is they're doomed. In 2017, the county said, you got to tear these things down because they're falling apart and they are a public hazard. So if you want to pay your $40, I would go down there and pay it sooner than later, because the fact is these things probably aren't going to last forever. There are rumors of satanic rituals, arcane seances, paranormal activity of all manner, from UFOs to ghosts to demons. So aside from like the ritualistic sacrifices, I think mostly kids drank and wrote things on the wall. You know, these things are weird, and I think growing up in these small desert towns, things like this ended up taking on just like a weird resonance. There was a coffin factory out where where I live.
In the same town?
Well...
Or nearby?
One town over, yeah.
Which town?
This was Coolidge. The only thing I ever found out there was a lot of bees once, but other than that, yeah. I didn't see any. And there was a bomb factory that I was always sure was not really a munitions factory, but in reporting this story, it turns out it was. Which is a weird thing, because I always assumed that was just something that people called this thing. But it was, in fact, a bomb factory. And again, both of these were prime locations for underage drinking. Yeah, you could get out there in a truck. You know, there's a couple dirt roads that'll lead you out there. You could also take four-wheelers out there, if you had four-wheelers. I don't know.
In Point Pleasant, West Virginia, there was an old munitions factory. Mm. It was a World War II ammo dump. And that was the epicenter of the Mothman sightings.
Ah, yeah.
That prophesied the collapse of the bridge over the Ohio River at Christmas time that killed 30, 40-odd people.
Yeah.
And so at one point, there were hundreds of cars from all over hillbilly country coming out on Friday night with six-packs and barbecues and making hot dogs and everything to watch for the Mothman, which
yeah.
was a seven-foot-tall, winged, dark-colored, or kind of like a hole in space, really,
yeah.
that
yeah.
just had these giant red eyes. Are there monsters associated with these monuments that you're aware of? You said demons.
Yeah, there was at least one monster that I was told about by some friends.
Tell us about this monster.
The Hoof Man.
The what man?
The Hoof Man. Yeah, it's a man with hooves. Kind of on the nose with the name there. But, yeah, what I was...
Like a pan kind of
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, sort of a pan. Again, he seemed to have a lot of devilish qualities.
Yeah.
I was told that there was something out there that would show up and terrorize kids who were drinking at these abandoned places.
So it's not the usual pan approach.
No, not the usual...
To merriment.
not the usual pan approach. He seemed slightly more malevolent. But he also was said to have frequented the casinos. So he seemed to have a... You know, you'd review the security tapes, and the guy who had won big, if you looked in the security tapes, you'd notice he had hooves
no.
for feet. That's,
which casino?
This is the Gila River Casino. Go to the river, the Gila River Casino.
Have you ever won big?
I've never won big, and I've never seen the Hoofman either.
But the two go together from what
yeah,
I've heard.
I think it seems like there's a distinct connection between the two. But yeah, these places are kind of weird, and I think that they, I don't know. I've always wondered, like, what should we do to preserve these places? There's no real utility for them, and they don't seem to have a great reason to exist, but I feel like they, I don't know, they mean something. They mean something to me. I think they seem to speak to the fact that in this weird part of the desert where nothing seems to be going on, it seems like a lot used to be going on, and there's something about that that's kind of beautiful and strange and weird.
And they're free places to go to. I mean, you can't...
yeah.
You're not welcome there, really, but...
Well, unless the owner shows up and he demands $40 for the
I'm
visit.
Sure Hoofman has not been there since the Instagram policy started.
Yeah, Hoofman was priced out. They are free spaces, and they are in their own way completely accessible places. Nobody gets to tell you what these places mean. Nobody gets to tell you what these places are. You sort of project your own meaning on them. And I feel like in that way, they have something to do with, I don't know, I guess art in the desert in a weird way. These things are like these weird spaces that we get to project all of our weird fears and dreams and our strangest ideas upon.
What's your favorite of these places? The one that you would most like to protect?
Protect? I'd have to say we should protect the Casa Grande domes because they look the most like something out of Star Wars. Very Tatooine-like. These strange colored domes rising from the desert door.
Now, I wonder about a lot of these things, if just the chance that anything survives in the Sun Belt tract home economy gives something a kind of weird magic because it, through luck or bad economic luck for the property owners, did
right.
not get run over with bulldozers and planted with golf courses and four-bedroom, 4,000-square-foot...
Yeah. Yeah, I think that if you asked anybody here in the room tonight, surviving in the desert, thriving in whatever manner you choose to define the word, is a little bit of a challenge. And so the fact that these things did survive, not only the elements, but unruly kids and all sorts of stuff, it does lend these things a little bit of a strange, lingering power. They seem to speak to what happens when you plant your flag deep enough in the desert soil and stick it out.
Thanks to everybody who came out for our presentation at the High Desert Nature Museum for the Morongo Basin Historical Society's Second Wednesday Lecture Series. And apologies to those of you who were turned away at the door. They packed in everybody they could, and then the fire department regulations took over. Speaking of fire, California is on fire again from the terrible inferno that consumed paradise outside of Chico and is still raging, to the fires in the Santa Monica Mountains, to a dozen smaller blazes threatening people and burning up our forests and our wildlife. Because we're coming into Thanksgiving week, we have got an unbearable number of tourists here in the high desert around Joshua Tree, more unbearable than usual. And of all the dumb things tourists do, the dumbest and most dangerous right now is believing the desert is somehow immune to wildfire. And so we are constantly calling the sheriff and the firefighters and the park rangers on people who are camping out illegally and building bonfires illegally and honestly threatening all of our lives, our homes, and of course the national park and the wilderness. Wildfires have burned through the high desert with regularity, and they are devastating, and there are large chunks of Joshua Tree National Park that are scarred by the wildfires of a dozen years ago. It has gotten so much hotter and so much drier here in the high desert that these wildfires are wiping out plants and animals that don't come back. Lots of mountains that once had forests of pinyon pines lost them forever in the fires of the early 21st century, and the pinyons aren't coming back. And in the lower elevations where the Joshua trees were already thin, the Joshua trees aren't coming back. What's coming back is some scrub brush and a few cactus and invasive weeds, and a lot of it just turns to sand and charred rock. The same way a desert preserve turns to sand when the mountain bicyclists decide they'll just ride wherever they want, to hell with the trails. And I've watched them turn many miles of desert crust that supported Cholla and blackbrush and even the occasional new Joshua tree into more lifeless sand covered in the tracks of bicycle tires. Boy, this place would sure be better off if nobody ever came here again, and I'll go too. Close it down, lock the gate. Well, it'll happen soon enough on its own. Good riddance to us all, and good night from the Voice of the Desert.
Thank you, Gallatin Valley, for listening. As always, you can call me and leave a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. Remember to spread the word that you can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 p.m. Sundays and 9 a.m. Mondays. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. That's it for today. So till next time, listeners, be safe, stay well, and sweet dreams. Happy Thanksgiving!